From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Malcolm Adekambi. I'm a straight-A student with nearly perfect SAT scores.
The new film comedy Dope is about an African-American high school senior who's into 90s hip-hop, Japanese comic books, and wants to get into Harvard. He's mocked for all of it.
I felt like I was that kid. I was like Malcolm. I was the kid who, had these sort of ambitions and oftentimes had people questioning those ambitions.
That's the screenwriter and director of Dope, Rick Famuyiwa, who's our guest today. He describes Dope as a celebration of kids whose interests don't fit into pop culture norms. Also, TV critic David Bianculli looks at how the late-night political comedy shows, including The Daily Show, have covered big stories like the Supreme Court marriage equality decision and the murders at the church in South Carolina. That's coming up on Fresh Air. The new movie comedy Dope is about three smart high school students of color who are obsessed with 90s hip-hop, have their own punk band, and are smart. That makes them the targets of mockery and worse in their predominantly black high school in a poor and working-class section of Inglewood, California. After a party that ends in a shootout, the main character grabs his backpack and finds that someone's put bags of drugs and a gun in it. He and his two friends have to figure out what to do with the drugs without getting killed or imprisoned. Pharrell Williams wrote several new songs for the movie. My guest is the film's writer and director, Rick Famuyiwa. He grew up in Inglewood, the son of Nigerian immigrants. He also directed the films The Wood and Brown Sugar, co-wrote Talk to Me, and is now directing an HBO movie about Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. Let's start with a scene from Dope. The main character, Malcolm, played by Shameik Moore, is applying to Harvard. He's talking with his guidance counselor about his college admission personal essay, which is titled, A Research Thesis to Discover Ice Cube's Good Day. The guidance counselor, played by Bruce Beatty, speaks first.
Malcolm, when I see stuff like this personal essay, I think you're not taking the process seriously.
I'm taking it seriously, Mr. Bailey, I promise. I'm talking about something that I love. I mean, it's well-reasoned, supported with historical data. It shows creativity, critical thinking. If Neil deGrasse Tyson was writing about Ice Cube, this is what it would look like.
I suggest you go in a different direction. Write something personal about you, your family, your life.
Yeah, I could write about the typical, I'm from a poor, crime-filled neighborhood, raised by a single mother, don't know my dad, blah, blah.
It's cliche.
This is creative. This shows that I'm different. This is the kind of essay that Harvard wants from their students.
Malcolm, I'm going to be honest with you. You're pretty damn arrogant. You think you're going to get into Harvard? Who do you think you are? You go to high school in Inglewood. To the admissions committee, your straight A's, they don't mean If you're really serious about this exercise, you're not just wasting my time or yours. Then it's going to be about your personal statement.
Rick Famuyiwa, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on the film. The essay that Malcolm writes is also a way of showing I'm different. You know, part of what pop culture means when you're a teenager, the music you love, the movies you love, it's a way of defining who you are. And I think you've really captured that with this film, how pop culture has like two purposes in young people's lives, just loving it, but also saying, that's who I am.
Yeah. I mean, that's so much of how we define ourselves. And I think particularly with young kids like Malcolm who don't have a lot of positive influences, pop culture almost becomes a larger part of that self-discovery and how you define yourself.
Is part of why your character of Malcolm is into 90s pop culture because that's the hip-hop that you grew up with, 90s hip-hop?
Yeah, I mean, I could selfishly say that that's, that's the case. I was in high school and college as hip-hop was really sort of coming into its own as a, creative force, as a sort of cultural voice. And it really spoke to me. That era in the late 80s through the 90s was really when the music was so new, fresh, energetic, but still creative. It hadn't quite gotten corporatized yet. And there was just a lot of exciting things happening. But it's interesting because a lot of young kids of this generation, sort of the millennials, for lack of a better term, I think reference both in terms of, you know, musical artists that are out now like Kendrick Lamar and A$AP Rocky who reference 90s sort of style, culture, bravado, and comment and flip those sort of ideas into sort of their new point of view. And so I felt like Malcolm is sort of similar to a lot of those young artists in that way.
So your movie is deep into hip-hop culture, but the heroes in your movie, they're the geeks, not the gangsters. They're the smart kids who have a band. They're immersed in movies and in music. They know their way around computers. The main character wants to get into Harvard, and he's really smart, and you're rooting for him that he's going to make it into Harvard. Was that part of what you wanted to do, to make a story where there's a young African-American as the main character? It celebrates hip-hop, but it's about being smart. It's not about being a gangster.
Yeah, I did. And when I was thinking about Dope and sort of the story that I wanted to tell, I was thinking about a lot of the films that influenced me, especially when I was in film school, and really deciding that this is what I wanted to do for a living, films like Menace to Society and Boys in the Hood, but also films like Bottle Rocket and Boogie Nights, and that took me on different journeys as well. And so the idea was that there could be a sort of different sort of idea about black masculinity. And so the idea was to sort of tell a story about the kids that not only live in this environment, but live in different environments around the country and the world, that sort of have a different point of view, that don't quite fit into sort of the societal norms of what people expect. And so the celebration of these kids who are geeks, who are into a lot of different things, but don't necessarily fit into sort of the accepted or sort of pop cultural norms, was something that I was thinking about doing more just on sort of a personal level, in that I felt like I was that kid. I was like Malcolm. I was the kid who, you know, had these sort of ambitions and oftentimes had people questioning those ambitions. And so I really wanted to just give voice to that.
So when you say people questioned your ambitions, do you mean they beat you up? I mean, I want to quote,
no.
I want to quote a line from the voiceover narration in Dope. Mm-hmm. It's like, for most geeks, the worst at school is being beaten up by the jocks. But in my neighborhood, it might be getting shot. So what were the black masculinity issues that you faced when you were in high school, and what kind of reaction did you get to your way of being a young man?
No, I mean, I never got beat up, but there is sort of, I guess there's always sort of a social shaming that goes on with adolescents, no matter what that is and where you're from. And the first clip that you played, where Malcolm is talking about his college application and he's dealing with his counselor, who basically asks him, who do you think you are for wanting to do this, to apply to Harvard? I had that similar type of experience where I had a teacher that I was very fond of tell my mother that, you know, I was arrogant because I had these ambitions to want to go to an Ivy League school and do certain things. And his point of view was that position made the other students in the class feel inferior, or when I would answer questions that people didn't know the answer to, that would sort of make everybody feel bad. And so I always thought about that exchange. And of course, my mother sort of, you know, went off on him and told him he was crazy. But I always thought about that because it sort of sat with me, you know, as a young kid hearing that, especially coming from a teacher that you really were sort of fond of, and how that sort of shapes your ambition.
So you mentioned the issue of masculinity and how it's defined for young black men. Mm-hmm. What did you feel defined masculinity when you were in high school, and how did that compare with your own self-image?
I think there's a certain expectation from the outside world about who you are, and you're always aware of that, whether it's growing up in L.A. during the 90s when there were just really a lot of tension between the police and sort of the communities that they often had to police, and having sort of those feelings and being aware of how people perceive you, whether it's going into a store or whether it's driving home from a party with your friends, and knowing that if a policeman pulls you over, how they think of you and what you have to sort of do in your own mind to prepare for that. And so I think there's always a self-awareness of how you're perceived to the world, because it's often something you have to deal with in sort of real world situations.
That leads to something that comes up in at least two of your movies. The Wood, which is an early film of yours, that set in the neighborhood you grew up in, Inglewood, and your new movie, Dope. In both of them, the main characters have to be careful, because if they accidentally start or intentionally start hanging around with like the wrong people, then they could easily end up in jail, because you never know, or maybe you do know, like who's carrying a gun or who's carrying drugs and who's just, you know, pulled off, you know, a crime of one sort or another. And if you inadvertently get pulled into that group of people, your life as you know it, as you wanted it, can be over. And I'm wondering if you faced that kind of threat to your future when you were growing up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that you're constantly dealing with. I mean, and in my case, Inglewood is sort of a microcosm of the larger Los Angeles. So there, it has its very affluent parts, and it also has its very sort of economically challenged and struggling parts, and everything in between. And so I sort of lived in a part that was sort of in between those two worlds, in between sort of the Ladera Heights, which was, you know, sort of where the really successful doctors and lawyers bought houses, and the Bottoms, which is where Dope is set. And I was sort of in a neighborhood kind of in between, kind of middle working class. And so I kind of lived in both of those worlds. It was always interesting, especially as I look back on things, you know, so many of the kids that end up becoming gangsters, drug dealers, whatever, I look back and I think of those kids as just sort of the silly kids that I used to run around the neighborhoods with, riding bikes, skateboards, and playing. But for different reasons, you end up in situations that sometimes, you know, take you in those directions. And there's a line in the movie about these kids have to deal with bad and worse choices. You know, there are no good and bad choices. Oftentimes it's sort of bad and worse.
What's the closest you came to making a choice that could have gotten you into trouble, could have gotten you, you know, imprisoned?
I was on my way to a dance with my friends, and this guy who was a sort of gangster knucklehead offered to give us a ride, and we knew him from the neighborhood, and all my, you know, my friends were like, all right, yeah, cool, let's get in, and I'm like, okay, fine. it is kind of a long walk, so let's jump in this car. And so we got in the car with this guy, and he gets pulled over by the police, and in that moment, as he gets pulled over, I'm sitting there thinking, this is it, you know. this is that moment where I just made a wrong choice, and we've now got pulled over by the police, and I have no idea what they're going to do or who this kid we're riding with actually is.
And what he's carrying.
And what he's carrying or what he's doing, and we're all going to go down, because these, you know, the police aren't going to care that I'm a straight-A student and I have all these ambitions. They're just going to see me as a black kid in the car with a gangster. And so the cop pulled us over, and the kid pulls out his registration, and it turns out this is his mom's car. And as everything, you sort of find out in life that there was so much more posturing than actual real gangster in this kid, because at that moment he became very polite. You know, as the cop came over, and well spoken, and the cop kind of let us go and was like, whatever, I forget he had a tail light or something, and let us go. But again, it was just sort of an incident that I know of other people who ended up in that same kind of incident, and they didn't get off that way. They did get arrested, and then that becomes something that's a part of their record forever. And so those are the sort of things, and they're small, you know, and they're innocent.
I don't want to get too deep into the plot of the movie, but let's just mm-hmm. say that because of a terrible mistake mm-hmm. that the three main characters in the movie end up with a backpack full of drugs that they have to figure out what are they going to do with it, because they can't mm-hmm. very well bring it to the police. Mm-hmm. This backpack now has a lot of, what is it, MDMA?
Yes.
And mm-hmm. and a gun. If they take mm-hmm. it to the police, like three young people of color taking it to the police, that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. There's like two sets of gangs out to get it. And mm-hmm. so like they don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. So what's your doorway into the drug aspect of the narrative?
Again, referencing the film Superfly and Boys in the Hood and Menace. And a lot of those films that I think I was playing around with in terms of my artistic process, drugs and the sort of drug culture often become a part of the narrative. And in some ways, I wanted that to be a part of this, that even though these kids were geeks and sort of trying to avoid that environment, they still end up somehow in this predicament. And so, you know, dealing with that was something that I wanted to deal with, and just metaphorically how the draw of that somehow ends up sucking even the best kids in. But I wanted to deal with it in a way that felt like how these kids would respond, and these kids are geeks and they're smart, and the way they're going to get out of the situation isn't going to be the same as the characters in those past films I was referencing. And it would be connected to technology and would be connected to the way that we interact with each other. So, you know, idea of sort of a marketplace like Silk Road, which has also been in the news a lot lately.
It's part of the dark internet.
Yeah,
like a kind of black market.
Yeah, the dark web.
The black market, yeah. Amazon.
Exactly. The dark web became very fascinating to me. And I felt like, yeah, of course, you know, these kids that are geeks and obsessed with technology and a lot of things would sort of they would find that avenue in a way that others, protagonists, wouldn't. And so that becomes a big, a central plot point in Dope that I think is fun, but also, you know, had a sort of larger message attached to it.
And an element of real danger.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, they're stoners. That's funny.
Yeah.
It's like these kids don't even use drugs, but somehow drugs have entered their lives.
Yeah.
And it's a comedy, but you know that there's potential for real danger.
Yeah,
because there's real guns in this neighborhood.
Yeah, there's real stakes.
There's real stakes, and the mm-hmm. police won't say, oh, well, you're smart kids, so it doesn't mm-hmm. matter.
Yeah, exactly. There's real stakes, and I often say that, you know, these kids are very similar to the kids in Breakfast Club or Superbad, but the stakes are a lot more real for them. You know, a mistake isn't just, you know, wrecking your dad's car or maybe, you know, getting arrested and stewing overnight for your own good, and then your parents come to pick you up in the morning and you've learned a lesson. It's like the stakes for these kids are real.
The three main characters at the center of the movie are, as we've been discussing, deep into 90s hip-hop. They're mm-hmm. into retro hip-hop. Yeah. They dress in 90s style. Mm-hmm. They love punk rock. They're in a punk rock band that's kind of part punk, part hip-hop. And one of the three characters is a lesbian. And I'm wondering if you had a close friend who was a lesbian in the 90s when you were in high school, or if you just wanted to write the lesbian character in there. She's a great character. Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a friend that was gay growing up. But as I was thinking about these three kids, and especially telling a story that I felt was about kids growing up today, I wanted to include that. And I wanted to have that voice sort of be a part of this crew. So for me, it was just important to get that voice in there, because I feel like that's where our world is going, that we're all sort of the barriers and things that divided us and what we consider mainstream and normal, I think is changing and changing for the better. That's how my kids deal with each other. And so it's something, a very sort of positive and empowering thing that I see and that I wanted to sort of have reflected in the movie.
So the three main characters, among the things they're into is skateboards, manga comics, which are mm-hmm. Japanese comics, mm-hmm. punk rock, Donald mm-hmm. Glover. and these are things that are all criticized for being white. Did you run into that in high school, the things you loved, you were mocked for liking because they were considered white?
Yeah, in high school, I was into a lot of different stuff, and I did ride skateboards, and now, you know, and I surf, and so it's something that I just kind of have always dealt with. You get that kind of immediate kind of reaction when you're this, you know, 6'3" black guy holding a surfboard, you know, going into a break, you know what I mean? And people kind of look like, oh, okay, now, you know, that's different. And so so I've always kind of felt that kind of thing, but not wanting to be confined.
My guest is Rick Famuyiwa, the writer and director of the new film comedy Dope. After we take a short break, we'll talk about being the son of Nigerian immigrant parents and about his use of the N-word in the film and in conversation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from USA Network. A lonely cybersecurity expert and part-time vigilante hacker meets the mysterious leader of an underground hacking collective who recruits him to help take down the world's most powerful conglomerate. Forbes magazine calls Mr. Robot the best show of the summer and on track to be a modern classic. Winner of the South by Southwest Audience Award and an official selection of the Tribeca Film Festival. Mr. Robot airs Wednesdays at 10, 9 Central, only on USA Network.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Rick Famuyiwa, the writer and director of the new film comedy Dope, about an African-American high school student, Malcolm, who doesn't fit into the pop culture norms of his predominantly black high school in a poor and working-class section of Inglewood, California. Malcolm is a straight-A student and wants to get into Harvard. He and his two friends are obsessed with 90s hip-hop and have their own punk rock band. Music plays a really big part in your movie Dope because the characters love 90s hip-hop, and because you do too, and also because you got Pharrell as the music director mm-hmm. of your movie, mm-hmm. and he wrote some original songs, which are the songs that the three main characters who are in high school perform in their punk rock band. It's mm-hmm. in the movie, they wrote the songs, but mm-hmm. the songs are actually written by Pharrell. So why don't we pause here and listen to one of those songs? And so this song is called Go Ahead. And tell us what you told Pharrell about what you wanted these original songs to sound like.
Mm-hmm. Pharrell came on board the project really early in the process. I hadn't even written the script yet. I'd had a treatment and a lookbook of sort of these kids and these characters and this world that I wanted to sort of live in. And so as we talked about the music that these kids would create, we started with hip-hop because obviously these kids were obsessed with 90s hip-hop. But we also felt, and we talked about how these kids would draw from many different things because they're of a culture that's connected to the world through technology in a way that we weren't. And so Malcolm and his generation has access to all types of music at the touch of a screen. And so hip hop would be at the root, but also punk and also grunge and also a lot of other things that these kids would have access to. And that became the jumping off point for the band Oreo that these kids created.
So this is a track of the kids in the band performing, and it's written by Pharrell. Are the actors in your movie actually performing on this track?
Yeah. They are singing. That's actually their vocals. They don't all play instruments, so that's other people that are coming in to play the music, but that's all their voices. They're all singing.
Okay, so here it is from the soundtrack of Dope.
Yeah, first day in school. Good grades are cool. New major boo. My mind is like a
That's music from the soundtrack of Dope, song written by Pharrell and performed by the three main characters. My guest is Rick Famuyiwa, who wrote and directed Dope. Your main character, Malcolm, is raised by a single mother who's a bus driver. His father is Nigerian, but Malcolm has only had basically one interaction with his father. And then we see, in a flashback, his father slipping through the mail slot of the house a DVD of his favorite film, Superfly, the father's favorite film. So let's talk about your story. Your parents are from Nigeria.
Yeah.
So did that set you apart when you were growing up?
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely, it's who I am. I'm first generation American. My parents were both from Nigeria. And so I always say that I'm literally an African American. You know what I mean? And so my last name is Famuyiwa. It's different. And so that was a part of my experience, from people not being able to pronounce it, to not sort of having sort of a shared common history with a lot of the kids that I was growing up with, because my parents were from Africa.
Your parents are from a majority black culture, mm-hmm. and then come to America where black people are considered the minority.
Yeah.
And did their coming from a majority black culture influence how you saw yourself as a young black man when you were coming of age?
Yeah, I think it did. And I think because they didn't have sort of the baggage in some ways that we carry when you kind of grow up in the United States, or, you know, I felt like they sort of had a point of view on the world that I got as well, a sort of ambition that became my own. And also a sort of point of view about the American experience, because they were immigrants too, and they came to the United States to go to school and ultimately live here and raise a family here. And so the idea of being American to them was something that was very specific and particular and something that they wanted. And the idea of being American for good and bad is something that I would always hear, you know, and there was sort of a constant refrain in my household about Americans this, Americans that, oftentimes not in the most positive light, but it was very much something that, as immigrants, you think about and deal with.
Were there things that you were into that your parents didn't understand, and maybe they especially didn't understand it because they didn't grow up in America or they're from Nigeria?
I don't know. My parents were pretty open about a lot of things, especially my mom. And any kind of little crazy thing I was into, she was very supportive of. You know, whether it was BMX bike racing or being in Boy Scouts or surfing or anything else, she always seemed to sort of support. And I think it's because she was an immigrant. And that idea of sort of having her kids be able to have access to their dreams and whatever they wanted to follow was very important to her. And I think she was very, very supportive of that. But yeah, I mean, I think there's always an expectation when you're a first generation, especially a first generation Nigerian, of sort of being a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer. And so, you know, sort of my initial pursuits into the arts and that I was going to pursue film as a career didn't confuse them, but it was definitely something that they were scared about.
I want to talk to you about the N-word, and the use of the N-word and who is allowed to use it and who isn't allowed to use it is still so controversial. And I'll offer as an example when President Obama used that word to make a larger point when he was talking to Marc Maron on Marc Maron's podcast. That made headlines. I mean, all the cable news shows were talking about it. It was front page of New York Times. Obama uses the N-word. There's a scene in your movie Dope in which the three main characters of color are talking to this like white hippie drug dealer who's a really funny character. And he listens to so much rap that he likes to use the N-word, you know, when talking to his white friends. And so he's talking to these three young people of color and using the word, and they're going, no, you can't use that word with us. Like, you're not allowed to use it. It's a very funny scene, and I'm not going to do the comedy of the scene justice, obviously. But given that you have a whole funny scene about that, and given what a very controversial word that is. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the use of that word and how you felt about that word growing up in the 90s, hearing it so much on hip-hop, if you've used it yourself in the kind of, you know, friendly insider way that it's that it's often used. Okay, your turn.
Yeah, it's a word that ends up in the movie because I wanted to be authentic about how these kids speak, and it was the way I spoke growing up. That's influenced by many different things that predates hip hop. And so that was just part of the sort of normal vernacular of how we communicated with each other. And it is, it's the part of the way that a lot of black people communicate when they speak. And so the idea of sort of who can use it and who can't has sort of been a historical thing that took on another wrinkle as hip hop exploded onto the scene, started into the 90s and obviously through the present day, because it's in the same way that I sort of reflected the reality of kids growing up in my environment, hip hop reflects that reality too. And also generationally, I feel the younger generations don't feel the same sort of weight and impact of the word that older ones do. It was just something that I wanted to throw into the mix. And so who uses it and how it can be used is something that's changed and defined. And so when the president uses it, it becomes about who can't use it and why they can't use it. And that was something that I wanted to deal with.
Did you have a problem with the president saying it?
I didn't have a problem with it. Because, again, I feel like he was expressing a certain thing, and it is a word. You know, it's a word that's not going to go away because it has a negative history, and so I didn't have a problem with them using it. It's a word that we can't hide from, and we have to sort of deal with its history and sort of how it's sort of been incorporated in culture now.
So how did that word play in your house? Again, you're the son of Nigerian immigrants. So
I didn't use it at home, no. that's how it played.
But they probably knew that you used it, or maybe they didn't? Maybe they had feelings about the word, whether they thought about you using it or not?
It wasn't anything we ever discussed, because I think, you know, to me, the word is sort of like any other curse word. It's like, okay, I'm just not going to speak a certain way in front of my parents. And I'm sure they know they were saying a lot of different things. So it didn't come up in that way.
Do you still use the word in conversation?
I do. When I'm hanging around friends and we just sort of talk, and yeah, we do. And it's nothing that I am particularly self-conscious of or ashamed of in any way. It's just a part of the way I speak sometimes. But I think that applies to everyone. We all sort of speak in a certain way when we're in informal environments that we may not do on fresh air.
So you've released this movie Dope, a very kind of vibrant comedy, at a time of real tragedy. There's been so much media coverage of shootings of young black men by police, protests of those shootings, the murder of 9 people in the Emmanuel AME Church in South Carolina. I'm wondering about the experience of releasing this just like wonderful comedy at a time when there's like so much tragedy. And there's not just tragedy in the world. But nevertheless, I'm wondering if it's something that you've thought about.
Yeah, it is. And even as I was writing it, it was something I was thinking about. As I was writing the script, was right in the middle of the Trayvon Martin incident. And so I was thinking about comedy and how comedy in many ways opens us up to ideas, and really being influenced by Richard Pryor and sort of the way he would use comedy to really speak about larger social issues. And as this film is released and as sort of these incidents have happened and increased and become more visible over the last few years, it just so happens to fit into sort of that conversation that we're having on a larger scale about race, about young black men and young black kids, just about how we are all dealing with each other, the N-word and everything in between that I didn't necessarily set out to do, But I think I was just sort of listening to my environment and felt like comedy was the way to sort of deal with that in a real and personal but also fun way.
Right now, as we speak, you are shooting a film called Confirmation that involves the Anita Hill hearings mm-hmm. and the confirmation of Justice Clarence Thomas. Mm-hmm. The only other thing I know about the movie is that Kerry Washington stars as Anita Hill. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us something about it?
Yeah. Confirmation does star Kerry Washington as Anita Hill. Wendell Pierce, who's known from The Wire and Tremé, is playing Clarence Thomas.
Oh, really?
yeah. And Greg Kinnear is playing Joe Biden,
who was the
chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee at the time. And so the film is written by Susanna Grant, dealing with the several-week period of that confirmation hearing and how these two people's lives were thrust, their private lives were thrust into the public realm in that early 90s as the 24-hour news cycle sort of combined with the racial and gender dynamics of that hearing just sort of exploded for these few weeks and riveted the nation. And so it's really just dealing with that confirmation period, not necessarily about who was telling the truth and who wasn't, but really about the process. And so that's really the point of view of the film, is to try to be as objective as possible, knowing that that's, you can never be completely objective, but feeling like we're really just going to examine that time period and that crucible that happened, hard to believe, almost 25 years ago now. But
Where were you during the hearings?
I was a freshman in college, and as I said, I was a political science major before I applied to the film school. So this was very much on my mind as it was going on. You know, we were, you know, in the program following closely what was going on with the hearing ever since Marshall announced his retirement. And so I vividly remember watching this and being riveted by it throughout the whole process and thinking back on that time, wondering, you know, what I really felt about it, because I had sort of strong feelings about it, and wondering if my history has sort of affected what I think I thought about it then in some ways. But I was really, it was really sort of a, just to see these two accomplished black people on TV and tearing each other down in some ways was always kind of problematic to me. And so when this project came around, it felt like something that I really wanted to address on the film scale.
Well, I look forward to seeing it. Rick Famuyiwa, thank you so much for talking with us.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Rick Famuyiwa wrote and directed the new film comedy Dope.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from A24, presenting Amy, a documentary about Amy Winehouse, a once-in-a-generation talent who lived her life in front of the camera and disappeared in front of our eyes. A star is born all over again, says The Guardian. IndieWire calls Amy an extraordinary, powerful work. And The Village Voice says, it's a rush of joy and grief. Amy, New York and Los Angeles, July 3rd. Everywhere, July 10th.
The last few weeks have been an amazingly busy news cycle with a mass shooting at a South Carolina church, landmark Supreme Court decisions being handed down, and more presidential hopefuls announcing their candidacies. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, has been following it all, but not just on the standard news outlets. He says he's learned a lot, in both tone and substance, from TV's cable comedy shows, the ones hosted by Comedy Central's Jon Stewart and Larry Wilmore, and by HBO's John Oliver and Bill Maher.
Yes, what a week, huh? The Confederate flags are coming down and the rainbow flags are going up.
That was the opening of last Friday's Real Time with Bill Maher, when the host comically summarized recent events. Calls for the Confederate flag to be removed from prominence in the wake of the South Carolina killings, and a Supreme Court ruling supporting marriage equality in all 50 states. It was one of the court's rulings, support of the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, was another, that had some conservatives questioning not only those decisions, but the Supreme Court itself. On The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, here's news footage of remarks by Republican presidential candidates Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee, followed by Jon Stewart's incredulous reaction.
And what a crazy system to have the most important issues of our day decided by unelected lawyers.
Five unelected black-robed lawyers rule. That is not the America that our founding fathers created.
Then why did they put that article in the Constitution?
What impresses me so much about these shows, by Bill Maher, Jon Stewart, and by Stewart protégés John Oliver and Larry Wilmore, is not just that they proudly present a point of view in an entertaining way. Most of them also make room for a deeper and more honest discussion than you'll find on the Sunday morning public affairs shows. And in addition to keeping the television news outlets honest by checking, questioning, and often ridiculing their remarks, they do the same for the newsmakers themselves. Here's John Oliver last Sunday.
This landmark decision inevitably drew a dissent from Antonin Scalia, a pizzeria chef statue that came to life but never acquired human emotions or empathy. And Scalia was emphatic in his response to Roberts.
His opinion sparked a blistering dissent by Justice Antonin Scalia, who took the unusual step of summarizing it from the bench, calling the court's reasoning absurd, interpretive jiggery-pokery, and pure applesauce.
I'm sorry. Jiggery-pokery? Pure applesauce? Are you a justice or a Victorian dowager writing an angry letter to Prim and Proper Ladies Monthly magazine? Listen, Scalia. Let me answer you in terms that I think you'll understand. Because, yes, the court's ruling was a bit frippity-frappity, but I say this. If it takes a touch of goofery and baba ganoush to help people, to help keep the people of this great nation healthy, well, then, by hiblet or by giblet, bring on the hoople and zizzle-zazzle, because that's the kind of country I want to live in. I said good day, sir. Blueberries. Blueberries and custard, sir.
Another prominently divisive issue in the news recently, of course, is the Confederate flag. And Larry Wilmore, whose The Nightly Show had its strongest week ever in terms of content, threw in his two cents without any hesitation or any equivocation.
For the record, the Confederate flag is not a proud symbol of tradition or heritage. It's a symbol of oppression and intimidation. That's not my opinion. That's an objective fact. On March 21st, 1861, the vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander H. Stephens, stated that the Confederate government was based on the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man. That speech is now called the Cornerstone Speech because that idea is the cornerstone of the Confederacy. You don't get clearer than that. Now, some people say that Southern states should fly the Confederate flag because it's a symbol of their heritage. But if we flew every flag from our past, why aren't we flying the Union Jack in front of the White House? Right? And for the record, South Carolina, you don't get to make the heritage argument because the Stars and Bars hasn't been flying over the state house since the Civil War. It went up in 1961 to mark the centennial of the Civil War. And coincidentally, right around when the black people started with the wanting of the civil rights. In 1961, it was a reminder to black people that they should know their place. It has always been used as a symbol of intimidation and terror. And that's what it remains today. In fact, because displaying the swastika is illegal across much of Europe, skinheads and neo-Nazis often adopt the Confederate flag in its place.
Yes, they do.
It's such a racist symbol that it does double duty as the backup racist symbol for another racist symbol. That's crazy.
On the regular news outlets, there was lots of discussion about whether the killer in South Carolina was motivated by hatred of race or religion. On this point, too, Wilmore was quite clear, to the point of being blunt.
I know because this was in a church that it's hard to understand this was about race, but let me give you an example. Four black girls were murdered in a church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963, all right? Back then, no one pretended to wonder what the motivation was. If you tried to say it was about religion, even the perpetrators back then would have corrected you, all right? No, we killed them because they're Negroes. That's why we did it.
And in one of his roundtable discussion segments, Wilmore put the whole discussion of race and racism in a memorable conversational context.
You've heard of this term, Columbusing. You guys ever heard this?
I have heard of it.
It means like when white people discover something that everybody else already knew.
Like America. Columbusing.
Yeah. Like, I feel like this whole church, this horrific church thing, has allowed white people to Columbus the fact that racism is still going on. Like in the 60s, in the civil rights era of the 60s, when a lot of these things that were happening to black people was put on television, white people got to Columbus that. You know, it's right. Like, oh, racism is happening. Yeah, it's been happening for a long time, but thank God for...
Television is allowing us to discover things around us and look at them in new ways all the time. But while in the 1950s and 60s, it was the broadcast evening news shows that helped us to discover the atrocities of racism and the Vietnam War, today we're just as likely to learn and to be moved by going to more unlikely sources. President Barack Obama visits Mark Maron's podcast and talks bluntly about race. On BBC America, Obama invites TV Nature host David Attenborough to the White House to hear Attenborough's ideas about what humans have done to the planet. That's all politics, too, and there's reason to question the motives for these conversations as well as to listen to the content, which, in a wider context, is precisely what these cable comedians are doing. It's a very public service and a very valuable one. Even with all the punchlines, we can all benefit from a little Columbusing.
David Bianculli is the founder and editor of TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Adam Liptak, the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. He'll analyze the term that just ended, examine some of the biggest decisions, and we'll talk about what Liptak describes as the court's drift toward the left in the last 9 months. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. John Myers directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.